I think we all want to do everything we possibly can to make sure he's never out in the community again, that he takes his last breath in a cage.
A convicted Anchorage killer admits to three more murders. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, June 20th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Congressman Don Young gets a reprimand from the House Ethics Committee for travel and gifts.
People who are campaign supporters, there are people who, you know, have an interest in transportation, there are friends of his, so that all gets sort of mixed together sometimes on these trips.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you're ready to quit tobacco or just thinking about it, the coaches at Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line, a free service for all Alaska adults, can support you with Text to Quit, with tools to make your quit attempt successful. Text to Quit helps you stay in touch with your quit coach, use nicotine replacement medications properly, manage those urges to use tobacco, and prevent relapses, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
The Anchorage Police Department and the FBI are investigating claims by convicted Anchorage killer Joshua Wade that he is responsible for three additional murders, dating back to when he was a teenager. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
In 2009, Wade pled guilty to the 2007 killing of Mindy Schloss and admitted to the 2000 murder of Della Brown. Earlier this year, Wade gave law enforcement officials information about three other murders he claims to have committed. Officials believe two cases involve the unsolved murders of 38-year-old John Michael Martin in 1994 and 30-year-old Henry Oktusaruk in 1999. Wade also says he killed another man the same night he killed Della Brown, though that victim's identity is unknown. Anchorage Police Detective Sergeant Slav Markowitz says law enforcement is investigating Wade's claims and re-examining old evidence.
We keep evidence in every homicide case forever. We don't dispose of the evidence. There are new advances in technology, DNA. We may analyze the evidence now that in ways that we were not able to do that in 1994 or in 2000.
Markowitz was unable to go into detail about the claims as the investigation is ongoing. Wade had been attempting to get out of his plea agreement in the Schloss case, which could have sent the case back to trial. But he agreed to drop his request and give law enforcement details on the three additional murders if they agreed to transfer him to a federal facility outside of Alaska. Karen Leffler is the U.S. Attorney for the District of Alaska. She says it's unclear why Wade requested the transfer.
When the state came to us in the Department of Law and said, would you be willing to, you know, talk to the federal authorities about taking him, my answer was, who cares? He's never going to get out of jail. I don't care where he serves it. He's not getting anything that harms the community from us. So if we can get some closure to someone, you know, our position was work with the Department of Law, see what they want. You know, he doesn't get out of jail. I don't really care what his motivation is. I just care that he never gets out.
Wade has been transferred to a maximum security federal prison in Indiana, where he will serve out the remainder of his life sentence without the possibility of parole. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
As Wade promises details about the additional murders, the family of one of his alleged new victims say they're feeling their loss once again, and they're angry Wade won't face new charges or a trial for the murders. Arlene Soxy of Nome says her son Henry Oktusaruk was 30 years old and living in Anchorage when he was killed in 1999. She says she first heard about the connection to Wade in February.
One of the detectives was talking to Joshua Wade, and he confessed that he was the one that killed my son. They were able to get in touch with one family member, and that was how they contacted us. And it was like he died all over again.
While investigators try to corroborate Wade's claims, it's still unclear whether he could face new charges. That, Soxy says, is not justice.
I was wishing that there would have been a trial for the murder of my son, and I was told that there would be no trial because he's in prison already. It seems like the law is for the people who have committed the crime and not for the family members that are left suffering.
As for Wade, he asked for a transfer out of Alaska for the rest of his life sentence. Soxy says the idea her son's alleged killer could bargain information to get anything at all offends her.
It angered me my son can't speak for himself, and to know that people in the governing system or the law allow things like that, it's not right either.
Whether Wade's claims on the additional murders prove true or false, he'll still remain behind bars for the rest of his life. The House Ethics Committee today issued a letter of reprimand to Alaska Congressman Don Young for spending campaign money on trips to hunting lodges and improperly accepting gifts, many of them from lobbyists and related to travel. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
The committee's letter focused on $56,000 worth of rides in private planes, stays at hunting lodges, golf, meals, and, in one specific instance, a pair of $400 boots. The committee says Young has to repay $28,000 to the gift givers and use personal funds to repay $31,000 in misused campaign funds. Young's spokesman said the congressman would not talk about the report today. In a written statement, Young said he regretted what he called oversights and apologized. He's already repaid the money.
Some of them are tough calls.
That's Young's lawyer, John Dowd. He says the people who hosted the trips played several roles in Young's life, so the purpose wasn't always clear-cut.
There are people who are campaign supporters. There are people who have an interest in transportation. There are friends of his. So that all gets sort of mixed together sometimes on these trips. And, sometimes it didn't get sorted out. Sometimes it did. So
Dowd says after the Justice Department investigation, Young laid out all the information about his travel for the Ethics Committee. The committee found Young improperly accepted gifts and 15 trips dating as far back as 2001 and as recently as last year. Most of the travel occurred from 2004 to 2006, when Young chaired the powerful House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee. At the time, he was raking in campaign contributions from the construction and transportation industries around the country. The gift givers listed in the report include former Young staffers who became lobbyists like C.J. Zane and Duncan Smith, Texas lobbyist Randy DeLay, and Tom Johnson, an executive at the Texas branch of Associated General Contractors. Many of the trips were to Texas lodges. The most expensive on the list, more than $11,000, was to the Mariposa Ranch in South Texas, paid for mostly by Houston-based construction conglomerate KBR. Lobbyist Duncan Smith bought the $400 Le Chameau boots. The company specializes in knee-high rubber boots lined in leather. The ethics case against Young originated with a wide-ranging Department of Justice investigation started at least 8 years ago. In 2010, the Justice Department said it wouldn't pursue charges against Young and instead sent a letter about him to the Ethics Committee. The panel says with such old evidence, it couldn't find that Young's acceptance of the trips and gifts was purposeful or corrupt. The committee, though, noted Young listed none of it on his required personal financial disclosure documents. Melanie Sloan of Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington says the punishment amounts to a letter saying, in effect, bad congressman. UAA political science professor Forrest Neighbors says he doubts the reprimand will affect Young's re-election in November. Violations like these aren't important to people outside Washington, Neighbors says. And anyway, Alaskans have been hearing about Young being investigated for years.
It doesn't seem to deter them from re-electing him. He has very strong relationships in the state.
Forrest Dunbar, the latest Democrat running against Young, has raised less than a tenth of the campaign war chest Young has. In a written statement today, Dunbar called Young a repeat ethics offender. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The state denies its laws on marriage curb the constitutional rights of five same-sex couples suing over Alaska's gay marriage ban. The couples, four married outside of Alaska and one unmarried couple, sued in federal court seeking to overturn the ban. In a filing yesterday, there is a claim-by-claim response to the plaintiffs. State attorneys say voters had a fundamental right to decide the important public policy issue of whether to alter the traditional definition of marriage. They say Alaska isn't required to recognize same-sex marriages performed in other states, and that as a sovereign state, Alaska has the right to define and regulate marriage. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, heavy rain and flooding in the Fairbanks area.
They've got 3 to 4 feet of water in their yard. They're saying this is some of the highest water they've seen since 1986.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's business dreams grow for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by Craig Taylor Equipment Company, celebrating 60 years in Alaska, providing equipment sales, service, and parts statewide since 1954. More at craigtaylorequipment.com.
The Fairbanks area has seen some impressive rainfall over the last few days. National Weather Service meteorologist John Lingus reports 2 to 3 inches around Fairbanks and 3 to 4 inches over the hills northeast of town. The heavy rains are causing flooding along rivers. National Weather Service hydrologist Ed Plum reports high water on the Chena River along Chena Hot Springs Road east of town.
1 to 2 feet of water is flowing over at mile 36.9. And it is impassable for some vehicles, and also reports of water over most of the banks out in the Chena Rec area and other places upstream of the Moose Creek Dam.
Gates on the Moose Creek Dam in North Pole are being lowered to shave off some of the cresting Chena, diverting flow into a spillway at the Chena Flood Control Project. Plum says that will limit high water in the cities of North Pole and Fairbanks. Meanwhile, he says flooding is also an issue on the Salcha River.
One of our observers about 20 miles upriver from the Richardson Highway Bridge, and they've got 3 to 4 feet of water in their yard. And they're in a cabin that's generally up on a higher bank, and they don't tend to get flooded as often. And this, they're saying this is some of the highest water they've seen since 1986.
Plum says the Good Pasture River is also high and likely overflowing its banks and flooding low-lying areas, adding there are cabins along the river. For 30 years, Alaska maintained a universal vaccine program where federal funding paid for all the standard shots. But in 2011, the money started drying up, leaving only the most vulnerable populations covered. Now universal access to vaccines may be back with a law that uses the state as a broker between insurance providers and pharmaceutical companies to get a bulk rate discount. At the bill signing this week, State Senator Kathy Geisel said the idea is to make sure everyone is covered.
All Alaskans, insured and uninsured, had access to vaccines.
On top of increasing access to vaccines, healthcare providers expect the law to save them time and money. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reports.
Hi, guys.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you doing,
Shannon? Oh, I'm getting shots.
Dr. Susan Beasley is walking through the offices of the Anchorage Pediatric Group.
Hey, guys.
She's practiced there for 5 years, but right now she's not on the clock.
Today I'm here as a mom. I'm here for my 2-month well child check with my daughter, Robin Beasley.
Her baby will be getting immunized against whooping cough and tetanus, diphtheria, and rotavirus.
So today she's getting 1 oral vaccine and 3 shots.
While getting shots may be a new thing for baby Robin, immunizations are a big part of what the Anchorage Pediatric Group does. Beasley alone sees about 20 kids every week who get vaccines. When Beasley first moved to Alaska in 2009, the state still had universal vaccine coverage. It didn't matter if you were a kid, an adult, insured, or uninsured. If you were getting an ordinary vaccine, the federal government was probably footing the bill.
Slowly over the past 5 years, we've lost that. And it's sort of been a stepwise progression from having universal coverage to then just at first a couple shots weren't covered universally, and then slowly all of them have now been sort of changed over to a 2-tier system.
Public funding covers about a third of the shots administered by Anchorage Pediatric Group. The rest are billed to the insurance companies or to the patient. To avoid a billing mess, the group has to make sure the vaccines are stored according to who pays for them, even though the shots are identical. That means keeping the same exact vaccine in separate bins in refrigeration units divided by plexiglass. Some clinics have to spend extra money on entirely different refrigerators for different types of patients. And no matter how organized a group is, Beasley says there are occasional mix-ups when it comes to distributing the public supply and the private one. And those vaccines are not cheap. While we're waiting for baby Robin's appointment, Beasley grabs practice administrator Bryce Alexander to explain just how much money their group spends on them.
The cost of the vaccines, some of them are upwards of $200 just for the serum itself.
Alexander says the Anchorage Pediatric Group fronts $40,000 a month on vaccines for patients who don't qualify for the public immunization program before passing that cost on through patient bills. But starting next January, the group won't have to do that. The state of Alaska will be implementing a system where they act as buyers for vaccines. They'll assess insurance companies and private practices a fee, and then use that money to buy vaccines for providers at a serious discount. In states with similar programs, access to vaccines has increased, making disease outbreaks less likely. Providers, patients, and insurance companies have saved millions of dollars. The new system also means hospitals and clinics won't have to segregate their vaccines anymore or bill them differently. Alexander expects that to be a time saver.
So not having to worry about explaining to patients why they have such a huge bill, it's much easier to focus on, yeah, you showed up for the visit, this is your bill for the visit, and everything else is covered.
Beasley also welcomes the change.
The bottom line is just that it's such an important preventive service, and we want to be able to provide it exactly the same to all of our patients.
While the new system should make work easier for Beasley and her colleagues, the actual shots themselves are not as much fun for Robin. Beasley and her husband speak gently to their daughter as the nurse preps her for the vaccines.
That's okay.
After not too long, the crying stops, and the nurse sticks on some sparkly Band-Aids. Robin is ready to go until the next round. In Anchorage, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
This weekend, you can expect hundreds of fishing enthusiasts to crowd Ship Creek in Anchorage, trying to snag a monster king salmon. The fishing frenzy is part of the Slam and Salmon Derby, a 10-day-long competition and fundraiser. Prizes are given out for the largest fish caught, and donations are directed toward the downtown soup kitchen. While the Derby has seen disappointing runs in the past, Dustin Slinker, owner of Ship Creek Bait Shop, says this year's season is off to a good start.
The Slam and Salmon Derby is doing quite well this year. Here in downtown Anchorage, you can catch a 40-pound king salmon when a lot of the other fisheries in the state are under emergency orders and shut down.
More than 100 salmon have already been entered into the Derby. A new hatchery program that started in 2012 is partially credited with the abundance of fish this year. The competition wraps up on Sunday.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. And by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Aleknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, fry bread. Fry bread, that high-calorie treat that can go savory or sweet, has generations of history in many Alaska Native families. KTOO's Jeremy Shea hung out with a local master of fry bread making and tried to find out how the untraditional food became a cultural fixture.
Are you salivating yet? Some people say that's magic happening in a stainless steel tub of hot canola oil. Magic that turns a hand-stretched disc of dough into a puffy, but not too puffy, piece of golden, delicious fry bread. Garfield Katash is the big guy under the tent by the Garfield's famous fry bread banner. On days like this, during a big Native cultural convention, Katash spends hours on his feet, patiently working the dough and frying it up piece after piece after piece.
150, 170 pounds, 175 pounds of that dough.
That's just one day's dough, all mixed by hand.
You know, my day starts 4 o'clock in the morning and doesn't end till 10:30 at night.
10:30 at night?
Yeah, because I have to run around, get all my ingredients, and get ready for the next day.
That funny squeal is coming from the headphones Katas wears, plugged into a gadget clipped to the collar of his hoodie. He's got severe hearing loss, and it helps him get by. He says his disability makes it tough for him to work a regular job, but also lets him travel and sell fry bread to thousands during events and festivals. Katas has been setting up shop in the Juneau and Anchorage areas for about a decade. He grew up in Juneau, but lives in Albuquerque and Anchorage most of the year. Even without four walls or a roof over his business, he's become a local institution. Carmen Plunkett, who's from Juneau but now lives in California, was carefully packaging 8 pieces of the plate-sized treats.
And we love our fry bread. As you can tell, I now take it back and I freeze them, take them back, and I can have them later because there's no, I can't cook it myself.
You can't get it down in California?
Not to this, not like this here.
Even in the rain, his customers keep queuing up in the parking lot where he's set up for a few days.
I love Garfield's fried bread. He does the best fried bread.
That's Betty Ann Boyd. By the end of Katas's first week in town, she'd eaten 4 pieces.
And it's light and it's big, and he always has good conversation while you're getting it.
Boyd, Plunkett, and many others in line are Clinkett. They remember their first time eating fry bread made by their parents and grandparents when they were young children. And yet, Smithsonian Magazine and popular lore attribute fry bread's origins to the Navajo. Katas, who's Clinkett but spent a lot of his adult life in the Southwest, says his recipe came from a Pueblo friend. Sometimes he sells fry bread topped with Mexican ingredients as an Indian taco, though he personally enjoys it with salmon and green chili. Many Native American groups around the country have variations of fry bread. How it's come to be so closely associated with Alaska Native cultures is a bit of a mystery.
I don't know too much about the history. I just know it brings a lot of people together.
I never questioned it because it was part of our, you know, what we ate. I never thought of it. I enjoy my food, so now what? You have me questioning it.
Okay. Do you have any theories or have any reaction to hearing it's a thing up in Alaska?
I don't have no theories.
That last guy on the phone was Dwayne Lewis, a Navajo and owner of the restaurant Sacred Hogan Navajo Fry Bread in Phoenix. Lewis says he remembers his grandma saying fry bread was first created when the government was rationing food to the Navajo. Like matzah is a symbol of Jewish persecution, Navajo fry bread has a lot of history, symbolism, and emotion kneaded into it. In the 1860s, the U.S. government forced the Navajo and other Southwest Native American groups to relocate to a doomed settlement. Traditional foods grew poorly on the reservation. Starvation led the government to provide canned goods, flour, sugar, and lard, which led to fry bread. For Katas's customers in Alaska, fry bread doesn't appear to have that baggage. Darren Austin doesn't have a trace of ambivalence while he eats.
Pretty good. I like how he makes them big, too. Has that big tub. Sweet. You got the sugar on there, the butter. You know, it's buttery. And it's crispy. It's fresh out of that oil.
Katas keeps his recipe under wraps, but does share one key additive.
I say my prayers over every time I do 10 pounds of dough for everybody that walks across my booth, buys bread, that they would be blessed and nourished.
When people ask him, what's your secret? He says that's it. There's no magic involved. In Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week we're heading to the hub community of Bethel on the Kuskokwim River.
My name's John McDonald, and I live in Bethel, Alaska. Bethel's 90 miles up the Kuskokwim River, which is the second largest river in Alaska next to the Yukon. And it's a fairly rolling tundra here. The mountains aren't far away, though. They're about a 40-minute flight by float plane. You can see the mountains. And they form this great delta here, this Cetron and Kuskokwim Delta. I just always thought when I got here that this is sort of where I belonged. It was a really nice place to raise our two children who are, you know, grown and gone now. But it was, I think they would say that too. It was a really good place to grow up. People who come here and embrace the culture and the outdoors, if you like the outdoors, and if you, you know, have a boat or something, or like to fish or just camp or bird or anything like that, hunt, it's a, you know, people like that tend to get attracted to Bethel. Well, it's a hub city, always has been. All the barges from Seattle come here, and we get about around 10 barges a year that are full of all of the supplies for the year, all the lumber and cars and fuel. Everyone from the villages, the 50 or so villages that surround Bethel, you know, depend on this hub to come and get their supplies. And then the large regional hospital here, the largest native hospital in the state, is here. It employs lots of people. And the airport's the third busiest airport in Alaska. So it's a very busy place out there. Bethel's grown a lot since I've been here. I got here in 75, and I think there's like 2,000 people or something, and now there's over 6. The town's growing, and it's always been a good place to live for me.
John McDonald lives in Bethel. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Jeremy Shea, Joaquin Palomino, and Annie Fite. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Matthew Smith in Nome and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez, Josh Edge, and Joaquin Palomino reported from Anchorage, and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
Alaska Mental Health Trust beneficiaries are important members of our workforce, from healthcare facilities and nonprofit organizations to retail stores and restaurants. Alaskans who are in recovery or experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, or mental health conditions are succeeding in the workplace. The Trust encourages businesses to consider ways in which employing trust beneficiaries can be good for business. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust. Attention, Alaska gardeners. Invasive weeds are a threat to landscaping, lawns, and gardens. They can spread and harm Alaska wildlife and waterways. Potted plants, hay, gravel, and soil, even clothing and vehicles can transport invasive plants to Alaska. So learn more at alaskainvasives.org. Let's protect Alaska together. Visit alaskainvasives.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Division of Agriculture and the U.S. Forest Service.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.